Calling case number 29035, Sierra Club versus Department of Transportation. Arguing for the appellate's possibilities, the Sierra Club, Maui Tomorrow Incorporated and Huffingly Harbor Coalition, Isaac Hall. Arguing for the appellees, Cross Appellants, Hawaii Super Ferry Incorporated, Lisa Munker. Also appearing for the appellees, Cross Appellants, Hawaii Super Ferry Incorporated, is Carly Minner Cole. Arguing for the appellees, Cross Appellants, Department of Transportation, State of Hawaii, Lisa Ginoza. Also appearing for the appellees, Cross Appellants, Department of Transportation, State of Hawaii, is Bill Weinhoff. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Chief Justice Moon, associate members, justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court, Judge Town. May it please the court, my name is Isaac Hall. I represent the Sierra Club, Maui Tomorrow, and the Kapolei Harbor Coalition, whom I'll refer to either as the appellants or the Sierra Club. I'd like to devote 25 minutes to my opening remarks and 15 minutes to rebuttal. And thank you for the additional time. There are a number of significant issues, and I'm going to try to address just the pivotal ones this morning. We were here before you a year and a half ago. At that point, you issued a landmark decision establishing procedural standing for the first time, voiding the exemption determination of the HDOT, declaring that an EA was to be prepared pursuant to Chapter 343, which by legal implication required that an EA be prepared with the content requirements of Chapter 343 according to them, that the non-implementation requirements of Chapter 343 be in effect, that any leases or licenses be voided after the date of the negative declaration on February 23rd, 2005, in accordance with Cape Ho'o versus Kane decision authored by Justice Acoba, and that basically, the main claims in that case had been decided by you in a final decision, which was backed up by a judgment issued on October 3rd, 2007. There was remand, yes, but the remand was only on subsidiary issues and primarily for enforcement only. We had hoped that the case would be over, that is, that Super Ferry and DOT, or DOT would prepare the EA and the project would stop. But 2 days after your order was issued, HDOT and Super Ferry held a press conference and announced that they would accelerate the start date of the project, reduce fares, and go full speed ahead. That forced us to get a temporary restraining order, thereafter a preliminary injunction, and then participate in 4 weeks of evidentiary hearings, after which Judge Cardoza issued a permanent injunction that was supported by findings of fact and conclusions of law on two basic grounds. The first ground was legal, and that is the non-implementation provisions of Chapter 343 forbade the project from going ahead. And the second, he did not look at the non-implementation provisions of Chapter 343 and used a traditional balancing test and said there was a possibility of irreparable harm to multiple natural resources if Super Ferry were allowed to operate while the EA was being prepared, and thereafter issued the injunction. Super Ferry DOT at that point could have appealed to the highest court in the Article III hierarchy, the Hawaii Supreme Court at that time. Instead, they appealed, and I use that a little loosely, to the legislature, and went to the legislature and secured Act 2, came back to the trial court. The trial court dissolved the injunction, dissolved the order voiding the operating agreement, and over our objections, the trial court granted our motion for fees thereafter, and these appeals followed. Now, one of the primary claims before you today is that Act 2 is unconstitutional special legislation. Act 2, the Hawaii Constitution includes three provisions that forbid unconstitutional special legislation. Two of them are at play here. And those three provisions have been in the Hawaii Constitution since statehood, at least. The two that we're dealing with here, the first one is Article 1, Section 21, and that forbids special immunities and special benefits. And what the purpose of that is, and the purpose of all special legislation, is to forbid the legislature from conferring either special benefits or special immunities on individual entities when everyone else in the state of Hawaii has to comply with our general laws. And that's exactly what happened here. We've long had provisions in the case law, old cases, 1901, 1907, that said you can't have arbitrary classifications. But there are more recent cases that describe what arbitrary classifications are for the purposes of special legislation. First, there can't be some sort of description that makes it look like there's generality when there isn't. And here we have that in the form of a description in Act 2 throughout that we're talking about a large capacity ferry vessel. Throughout there's a description that creates a mask, and that's the term I was trying to be, a mask of generality, when there actually is no generality. And that mask is made clear that that's only a mask when we look to see that the Act is actually conceived, cut, and tailored for Hawaii super ferry alone. And that's a term that's used by a number of cases that say you've got an unconstitutional closed class of one. And that's what this is, because when you look at Act 1, in the first section, they describe a Hawaii Supreme Court decision about secondary impacts that can only be yours. They describe a reversal of a lower court determination that the exemption was valid. That can only be Judge Cardozo's initial determination. They describe the receipt of a certificate of public need from the Public Utilities Commission. That can only be the one that was issued in this case. They describe an operating agreement. That can only be the operating agreement that was agreed to between the Super Ferry and HDOT. They describe improvements at the Kahului Harbor. They can only be the improvements that were agreed to between DOT and Super Ferry at Kahului. They describe the grant, the allowance of use of 5.1, they don't use 5.1 acres, but state lands at Kahului Harbor. That's what was conferred by the operating agreement. So it's clear from the, yes, Justice Cohen.
The DOT claims that the Act creates a general classification for super ferries, and so this Act could apply to other entities. So how do you answer that?
Yeah, I think I am. Number one, there's a closed class. And then the second aspect of that, I mean, there's three reasons. The mask of generality, that's only a mask. Number two, for all the reasons I said here, it's actually a closed class of one. And the third reason is that there is the sunset clause.
What is there a closed class of one?
What
in the language indicates there is a closed class of one?
All the things that I'm pointing to, that there is only one entity that could fulfill all of these descriptions, and that's why it's super free. But the third, and to me, conclusive one is the fact that you have a closed class of one when there's only one entity that could come into the class or go out of the class, when the duration of the statute is so short that you can only have one entity. And in this case, Section 18 of Act 1 sunsets upon either this the completion, 45 days after the completion of the next legislative session, or the completion of this pseudo-EIS that's being prepared.
Under the text for special legislation, can we look outside of the language of the statute to facts outside of the outside of the statute or legislative history?
I don't think that you should in this case, because there was no evidence below that there was any other entity that could possibly comply with or could come into this class. I know that there was a footnote in the state's brief that there were some ferries in Nova Scotia or someplace that might possibly come to Hawaii, but the case law doesn't support, you know, rank speculation about some ferry that might come here at some future time. That's so speculative that it's not, you can't consider it, I don't believe. But I think the sunset clause clearly covers that given this short time period of the applicability of this particular Act 2, that there's no other entity that can enter or exit a particular class that's created by the legislature. And that, two things together, make it absolutely clear that the special legislation under Article 1, Section 21.
Mr. Ralph, I'm going to interrupt you.
Yes.
I'd like to talk about the Volgo case a little bit.
Yes.
It seems like there we verified a class of one. There's only one possibility of an unrelated public county fitting in that class. Are you asking us to overrule the Volgo case?
No, I'm not. I don't think that's what this court ruled in Volgo. I think Volgo said that it was general. They ruled in that situation that the statute was general because it could in the future apply to Kauai and it could in the future apply to the Big Island. That was the ruling of the court. It didn't rule that it was a class of one that would only apply to Maui County. That wasn't the ruling of the court.
Well, wasn't the focus on the rationale for the classification as opposed to the number of individuals or entities that would be in that class?
I think it said it did apply then, but I think with many of these cases, they're saying it would be general if in the future it was likely that other people could enter or exit that class. And in that case, they said it could apply in the future to Hawaii and the Big Island if the circumstances arose like it did there, that Eddie Dan died or was elected, died before he took office, that those circumstances arose on Kauai, or those circumstances arose on the Big Island, then it would apply there as well. So that it was general. That's what the court held in that case, I believe.
One last question in this area. Are you claiming that this was an unreasonable classification by the legislature?
I'm saying it's unconstitutional special legislation. I'm not quite sure what you're getting at, but I think the standard for special legislation is not the same as the standard for equal protection. It's arbitrary, I think is the term I've seen the most, that it's an arbitrary classification because it's a closed class of one.
Thank you, Adam.
Was there an end date in the statute involving it?
Yeah. I don't believe there was an end date.
So it would allow for any future events to be covered by that.
And I think that's the point the Hawaii Supreme Court was making in Volvo, that in the future it could apply to other counties.
And how does that differ from this case?
Because there is an end date. There's a sunset clause in Section 18 This Act 2 sunsets upon one of two events.
Is there a possibility that within the time allowed under this statute that other entities could fit, as in Volvo, into this classification?
I don't believe so at all. I don't believe that it's under any circumstances is there any other entity that could fit into this classification. It's clearly a closed class. Based on that it's conceived, cut, and tailored, if you look at all the descriptions in Act 2, they only fit Hawaii Super Fair. They don't fit anybody else. And on the second basis, the short duration of Act 2, those two together, I think, are decisive that it's unconstitutional.
How would the Volvo case be comparable to this situation if there were different facts in this case?
And how can we make Volgo applicable here?
Or how could this case be fit in the Volgo classification?
Well, I think in Volgo there were two other counties that existed to whom the same rule could apply. There aren't two other ferry companies in the state of Hawaii to whom this classification could apply. There never were.
Is that a matter of judicial notice?
Yes.
So your position is Volvo cannot apply because in Volvo there are other counties which might be able to fit into the statute in the future.
Well, that's what the court held in Volvo.
But here there are no other super ferry companies or entities that would fit.
It was not
within the time period of this statute.
Exactly. That's what you're saying. We're also saying that it's unconstitutional under the other provision in the state constitution, which Article 11, Section 5, which says the legislative power of the land owned by the state shall be exercised only by general laws. And this constitutional provision, for guidance on that, we have the Attorney General opinion that was written on September 11th, 2007, which is Attorney General Opinion 2007-02. And what happened there was the legislature directed HFDC to set aside 15,000 square feet of land in Puyallup Basin to a nonprofit entity. And the Attorney General issued an opinion and said that's an obvious violation of Article 11, Section 5, because the legislature is exercising control over state land and through special legislation. And that's exactly what happened here, that the court had voided the operating agreement, which was the only source of the only way that the Super Ferry had any right to use the state lands at Kahului Harbor. The legislature then came in and authorized Super Ferry to use those same state lands through special legislation. And Article 11, Section 5 forbids that kind of authorization. I know that the state has argued that it has to be some kind of sweetheart deal that hurts the state for this to be violated, but down at the bottom of the Attorney General opinion, what it says is basically more in line with special legislation law, which is what's forbidden is giving somebody a special benefit or immunity, whereas everyone else has to comply with special laws. In other words, to get state land, everybody else has to comply with the state laws regarding the disposition of state land. And here, they're getting land because the legislature is saying, here, you take this state land. And that's what's forbidden through Article 11, Section 5. So we're saying that violates that provision as well. We're also saying that it violates Article 3, the separation of powers provision in the state constitution. And there are a number of ways that the legislature can interfere with the judiciary, and there's a so-called clout manner whereby the legislature interferes with a judgment of a final judgment by the highest court in the state. And it's our view that the judgment that you entered October 3rd, 2007, is a final judgment by the highest court in this state, the Article 3 hierarchy in this state, that could not be interfered with by the judiciary later on when they did through Act 2, by the legislature, when they did in Act 2. And that takes a little bit of analysis of what was decided by you that couldn't be interfered with by the legislature. What was decided finally here was that an EA was required to be prepared pursuant to Chapter 343.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes?
If Chapter 343 has a non-implementation clause, then why was it necessary for the trial court to have hearings on the potential irreparable harm?
I'm not sure it was necessary for the court to do that. I think he could have...
Did you object?
Did we object? I think both sides took the position that he could have ordered early on that there be injunctions issued simply based on non-implementation. But nevertheless, he did go ahead and have 4 weeks of evidentiary hearings based on the traditional balancing test.
Could the non-implementation clause be enforced simply on the basis of the judgment that was entered on the first appeal?
I think that's how the judge viewed it. I think Judge Cardoza viewed that since the EA requirements with Chapter 343 had been triggered, that the non-implementation provisions of Chapter 343 had been triggered. And I think he mentioned in his ruling that he had no other choice but to grant the injunction based on the non-implementation grounds. But for whatever reason, we had 4 weeks of evidentiary hearings on the balancing test and what actual harm might result from the operation of the Super Ferry in the interim. And he did make findings of fact, conclusions of law, that it was possible that irreparable harm would occur. that happened as well. But I guess going back to Article 3, since your judgment and your rules, there's some discussion about that, your rules describe the entry of judgment on appeal as a final judgment on things that you have decided. You did decide that the EA was required to be prepared pursuant to Chapter 343. That matter, the legislature was not free to interfere with. They were not free thereafter to say, oh, the non-implementation provisions can't apply anymore. That was a subject of the judgment that you entered. They were not free to take away our right of appeal. That was secured to us by your judgment. They weren't free to take away all the other things that they took away, some of the content requirements, some of the public participation requirements. The pseudo-EIS that they supplanted that doesn't comply with Chapter 343, we don't believe they were free to supplant after you had required an EA be prepared pursuant to Chapter 343, and most importantly, backed it up with the judgment based on power.
Are you claiming then that by our published opinion that was the final judgment, or the final judgment to follow?
Well, no. When you entered the final judgment, it became a final judgment. You entered a judgment on appeal on October 3rd, 2007. That was a final judgment on the issues that you decided in your opinion.
How do you handle the Robertson case?
Oh, yeah. That's a different theory of legislative interference with the judiciary. But I'm willing to address it. But Plow is sufficient in and of itself, I think. But Robertson's a different theory. Robertson's theory isn't dependent on a judgment. That presupposes there is no judgment. But the Robertson theory is that the legislature is not free to, let's see the language of Robertson. That they can't re-adjudicate or a case that's already been decided by a court. They can only amend substantive law. And I guess we cited NRDC versus Winters case, not because it was something you have to adopt that you do agree with dicta in those cases, but some good analytical tools that are in those cases for deciding when when a legislature is interfering with the judiciary. What they're saying, one factor is look at the timing. Okay, we look at the timing of going to the legislature. And timing in this case was Judge Cardoza issued findings of fact, conclusions of law, supporting a permanent injunction. At that time, HDOT and Super Ferry could have appealed to you that injunction. Instead, they essentially appealed to the legislature. And that's one indicia of an interference. The second is, did the legislature decide anything different from what the court decided? And in this instance, the legislature didn't decide anything different. They simply reweighed the same things that Judge Cardoza weighed and came out with a different result.
To get back to Robertson for a minute,
yeah.
There was a separation of powers challenge in that.
Yes, there was.
There was a change of law after the so-called judgment was entered, and as I understand it, the United States Supreme Court concluded that the new statute changed the law. It didn't change the findings under the old law, but it did apply the new law.
Well, I understand. Well, for one, in Robertson, there was no judgment, final judgment from the highest court in the hierarchy. That's what Plow is talking about. When there's a final decision from the highest court, the Article III hierarchy, and that's why I'm talking about it. That's Plow. So Robertson isn't a Plow case. Robertson is a different line. It has to do with pending cases where Congress or the legislature steps in before a final judgment is entered. So that Robertson is more about the legislature stepping in before a final judgment is entered. There was no final judgment in that case. But anyway, I know what you're saying. I agree with you that in Robertson, there was a conclusion in that case that they were not re-adjudicating the case. But I don't agree with that analysis in this case. I think it was being done in this case. And further, the second Robertson test is whether substantive law was amended. That's the second Robertson test.
But in this case, so then we're back to whether the final judgment was really entered by us in this case.
Yes, final judgment was entered by you. Because, I mean, you're, by your rules, you define a entry of judgment on appeal as a final judgment. That's what your rules say. The final judgment, or the entry of judgment on appeal that you entered on October 3rd, 2007, surely was a final judgment on the issues that you decided. It may take some effort to segregate out what you finally decided. To me, it's pretty clear that you finally decided that an EA was required to be prepared pursuant to Chapter 343. You didn't remand it to Judge Cardoza to decide whether an EA was required pursuant to Chapter 343. You decided that. That was done. So an EA had to be required by Chapter 343. You, as the highest court in the Article 3 hierarchy in the state of Hawaii, decided that the final judgment that you entered, that's it on that issue. Your remand had nothing to do with that issue.
It was the final judgment as to the requirement of an EA before the project could go forward.
Absolutely, because that's what the law is.
To that issue.
As to that issue.
There was a final judgment binding on the court and on the parties.
Absolutely.
Why didn't you submit a request for fees after that final judgment?
I knew you were going to ask. Somebody was going to ask me that. We got immediately immersed in 4 weeks of evidentiary hearings with no discovery, and we were just thrown into hearings that we just had. We had to devote ourselves to that, and that's essentially the reason we had no time to do that.
So is it your position that you are allowed under the rule to submit a request for fees with respect to the first appeal?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the latter.
That you are allowed under Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure 39 to submit a request for fees with respect to the first appeal. Is that your position?
I've read your rules. The rules don't have an absolute deadline. I'm not sure if I submitted fees for the first appeal now, I'm not sure how you'd entertain that.
So, it says 14 days. You have 14 days.
So. Well, there's something there that's not absolute, I know, but I'm not sure. And we didn't ask for that at the trial level, obviously. We asked for appeals, we asked for fees for the so-called third phase and first phase.
Are you waiving fees for the first appeal?
I'm not going to say that, but I think last time we were before you, I expressed my hesitancy to waive anything on oral argument. It always shows up in an opinion somewhere. Counsel waives such and such.
Do you say Volgo is not out?
I say Volgo is not out.
So we look to other jurisdictions, their briefs, we look to other jurisdictions.
Yes.
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 Are there any cases that you rely on which indicate that the expiration date, as you referred to, the appeal of that, played in those cases that are analogous to indicate special legislation?
Yes, I think we cited a number of them actually in our briefing.
Are there any cases that Super Prairie and the Department of Transportation cited, which indicate that the limitation or expiration date of the event or the legislation could still be looked upon as a general law?
I don't believe the Super Prairie or HDOT cited any cases on short duration. In other words, we addressed the argument on short duration. We addressed it. We cited cases. They did not cite any cases on, for instance, short duration is okay. They didn't do that. Likewise, with the argument of conceived, cut, and tailored, we made that argument, cited cases. They did not rebut that. They cited other cases and made arguments with regard to culpability.
This morning, this appeal is addressing the legislature's ability to deal with the important issues of the day. Here, plaintiffs have raised a variety of environmental concerns, and we all know that this case has a fairly long history and procedural history. But the legislature speaks on behalf of all of the people of this state, and in doing that, needs to balance all of the interests that we all have. That includes the environmental interests, as well as a number of others. And here, that is exactly what the legislature did. Act 2 specifically balances the public need for an innovative and alternative mode of transportation with the environmental concerns that have been raised throughout this litigation. So the legislature specifically chose to act in this situation and speak on behalf of the entire state. It is perfectly within their authority to do so, and Act 2 is indeed constitutional, as the circuit court found it. Now, before I can also do it,
Section 343 already balances the interests of the different parties.
Well, this is what I would say with regard to that, Your Honor, is that with regards to 343, it's a creature of the legislature, it's an enactment of the legislature. And certainly the legislature at any time has the authority to go back and change the applicable law as it deems appropriate. So I would suggest to you that, I mean, that's exactly what occurred here. With regards to your specific question, Act 343 does not require any particular action with regards to the type that Act 2 does. 343 says we shall study the environmental effects, we shall study things so that we have informed decision making when actions are taken under 343.
And all other projects, businesses have to comply with 343, is that correct?
That's not correct, Your Honor. It applies to use of state funds and certain other types of situations that are specified there. But I would suggest to you that, in fact, no, 343 does not apply to a large number of situations where there are activities ongoing by businesses and so forth.
And how many businesses does Act 2 apply to?
It applies, Your Honor, to large capacity ferry vessels with a capacity of 500 or more individuals and 200 vehicles.
How many businesses fit that description?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record in this matter addressing that. And I think this is getting to the question of special legislation, and I'm happy to address that particular issue. But from a factual standpoint, record standpoint, there really isn't anything in the record. I mean, you can, I suppose, take judicial notice of matters that you feel appropriate. But certainly in this record, there's nothing specific to that.
I wanted to read from Section 3, subparagraph 1, Act 2. It says, a large capacity ferry vessel company shall have the right to operate and the right to utilize comparably harbor improvements and other improvements and facilities on any island, pursuant to and subject to any and all agreements and contracts with state entities relating to the operation of a large capacity ferry vessel and the use of state harbor facilities. Is there any entity that would fit that description except for Super Ferry?
Again, And Your Honor, from a factual perspective, on the record, there's nothing.
I'm asking you.
Before this. Your Honor, on this record, there is no evidence in the court below or before you today. What I would like to do is, it's not a factual distinction. Here, the test really is the Vogel test.
I'm sorry. My question was, is there any entity that matches that description? I don't see it.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, that there may be other ferries out there, as we pointed out in our footnote 13.
Is there any other ferry that utilizes Kahului Harbor improvements pursuant to an agreement with the state entity?
Certainly not at this moment, Your Honor, that I am aware of. But
so the state has no agreement with any large capacity ferry vessel concerning improvements and utilization of facilities at Kahului, except for the agreement with Superferry, is that correct?
Your Honor, as contained in the record, there is an operating agreement with the state of Hawaii and Superferry. What I would like to point out to the court is in that operating agreement, there are specific provisions contemplating other ferries coming to this state. And specifically,
did they sign that agreement, these other ferries?
No, but I think the point is that that operating agreement as well contemplates that other ferries could in fact come here. Act 2 also contemplates the use of the harbor improvements by others. And I would point to you to Section 1D in Act 2.
Before 2009, 45 days after the legislative session.
On the duration issue, Your Honor, if I may, the duration issue really is a non sequitur here, because in the Volvo case, it was a closed class from the minute that legislation passed. Mr. Hall's, I think, characterization of that as applying in the future to other counties is absolutely incorrect.
In that, you say Volga was improperly incorrect.
Not at all, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that if you apply the actual test from Volga and the lessons from Volga, the duration issue is a non sequitur because it was a closed class from the moment that legislation passed. That dealt with a chairman of the Board of Supervisors of Maui County, got reelected in 1966 to the chair position. He passed away the next month, unfortunately. And the Board of Supervisors for the County of Maui specifically passed a resolution asking the legislature of the state of Hawaii to pass a law allowing for a special legislation to fill that position. So the legislature did. They passed the law that specifically said, and they passed this law in May of 1967. The law said if there's a chair or board of supervisors reelected in 1966 who passed away before January of 1967, then you may have a special election. By the time they passed that law in May of 1967, anybody who was going to die by January of 1967 had died. It was an absolutely closed class from the minute they passed that legislation. And by the way, clearly, it was that situation in mind that the legislature had when it passed that legislation with regards to the county of Maui.
I agree with you, it's a closed class. So if it's a closed class, then it's all incorrectly decided.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. In fact, I think Volvo.
Closed class is used in case law to indicate special legislation.
No.
Using it in a different way.
I disagree in the sense that a closed class, in fact, in many cases, has been acknowledged to be appropriate general legislation when you apply the test, which this court did in Volga, which is the arbitrary, capricious, reasonable test. The bottom line for that test, if you look at Volga, it talked to the purpose of the legislation. The purpose of the legislation, and therefore the classification as it applied there, was reasonable. What's important, I would really like to point out to the court, in Volvo, this court cited to a couple of very important authorities that really makes clear what the test is. First of all, it cited to the 1950 Constitutional Convention proceedings, because this Volvo dealt with a constitutional provision dealing with special law. And there, the The citation that this court had in Vogel, specifically to page 529 of those proceedings, it said there, as to general laws, it allows classification so long as those classifications are based on some valid reason. The other citation that the Vogel case relied upon was a case called Jones versus Power County. It's an Idaho case, and in that case, the test was specifically whether the class is capricious, unreasonable, or arbitrary. And finally, this is, I thought, very telling. In the Vogel case, it cited to a section of the CJS, the Corpus Juris Secundum. And there, if you look at that citation and read it, it says the statute is not special when the classification is fair or reasonable. If a person or things throughout the state are affected, that's very appropriate to this case. It's not about one company getting special treatment. It's about this innovative alternative mode of transportation being available to the entire state. That's why the legislature acted. It impacts all the state, not just one company. In the CJS, it also says that it's not special law when the law promotes some public interest. So it suggests to this court that the test in Vogel is in fact the absolutely right one. It is in fact the law of the state of Hawaii. It is in fact the law that existed when the legislature passed Act 2. And if that classification in Vogel was deemed appropriate and valid under constitutional law, then there's no question in this case where you do have a possibility, Your Honor, of others coming in. Clearly, in this case, this is not special law. The other thing I would like to try to address real quick on that is the Act 2 calls for an EIS because of the harbor improvements. It's not because Super Ferry is operating, it's because of the harbor improvements. These harbor improvements, once done, benefit other ferries that may come here. So it's not a matter of duration. Once the improvements are made, Your Honor, they can benefit whoever. No, well, I guess what I'm saying is, in Act 2, it calls for an EIS.
That Google doesn't talk about proposed case. It doesn't say this is a proposed.
Your Honor, it specifically says at 50 Hawaii, Act 58, that the county of Maui could be a class by themselves.
It says that it applies uniformly to a class of political subdivisions, and it refers to the fact that you have existing political subdivisions, meaning in this case, at least Hawaii and Kauai. So aside from Maui, there was Hawaii and Kauai, to which the act, when it was passed, would have applied.
There were other counties in existence.
There were other counties, but they say those are the two counties.
Well, there were other counties in existence, but there are absolutely no other counties who had a chair of the Board of Supervisors elected in 1966 who died prior to January of 1967. So that's
the challenge provision does not give the county of Maui any power which is different from that which the Act gives to the counties of Hawaii and Kauai. It neither favors nor discriminates against all.
That would be the case here as well. It doesn't favor.
So when the act, I just want to get an answer to my question. When the act was passed, there were two other counties aside from Maui that could have fit within that act, or had the potential of fitting within that act.
To that specific question, Your Honor, I'd have to say no, because there was no other.
Okay, I disagree with different. But assuming that there were two other counties that existed. There were two other entities that fit within the classification under the statute.
If your classification is a county of the state of Hawaii, yes. If your classification as specific to that law, having a chair of a board of supervisors who died prior to January of 1967, there was no other county other than the Maui County to whom that law applied.
If that's the case, and if that's the issue, that statute would only apply to Maui.
That's correct. And in fact, I think the court specifically referenced that. The court acknowledged that in its opinion.
Although it does say that in the future, it
could apply to the other counties, doesn't it?
It does not say anything about the future, Your Honor.
Okay.
And in fact, I don't think it could have. And I would like to point out to a couple of other cases, I think, Chief Justice, this was your question, whether there were other cases from other jurisdictions that had closed durations. And in fact, the answer to that is yes. In the Crucius case, the Illinois case, case that we cited, there, again, it was a closed class from the moment the legislation passed because it applied to riverboat licensees who were not in operation the year before. This legislation, I believe, was passed in something like 1999, and it said that if a licensee, and there are only 10 licensed operators in the state of Illinois, if a licensee was not operating in January of last year, you shall be able to submit another application to renew your license to the board of whoever operates the gambling operations in Illinois. But the point being that at the moment they passed that law in 1999, there was only one riverboat operation who had not been in operation the year before. Again, a closed case, a closed class from the moment that legislation passed. The other one is the Paul Kimball case, which is a case we cited out of New Jersey. And there, it had to do with hospitals getting certificates of public necessity and need. It said the class there was any hospital nonprofit operator who had acquired property prior to this act and who, for whom the municipality where they were going to build the hospital had made an appropriation. Again, all things that had to have happened prior to the legislation being passed. So the moment that legislation was passed in New Jersey, it was a closed case of one. And in fact, the New Jersey court said that this law was drawn with the BRIC situation in mind. BRIC was the township where this hospital was going to be built. And both in the Crucius case and the Paul Kimball case, the court said that it applied the reasonable test, which is essentially the Vogel test, so it is the Vogel test, and said that given the purpose of the legislation, number one, to build a hospital for the health and safety of the public, it is an appropriate classification, even though it was closed the moment the legislation passed.
I think even Sierra Club just gives the fact that there's a rational basis for the legislation. They cite Canister. I mean, is there a
Canister is the death penalty case out of Colorado. And what I would say to that is Colorado applies simply a test different than what this court adopted in Vogel. They have a much different test. And in Canister, that case called for legislation, address legislation, that said anybody who was convicted of a class or arrested for a class one felony, who hadn't yet been convicted, but where the prosecutor had indicated they were going to seek the death penalty, then this law shall apply to you. When they passed that law, there were only two people to whom that class applied. And in that case, the court said it's a closed class, therefore it's unconstitutional. It's directly contrary to what this court held in the Vogel case. The Vogel case and the Colorado cases simply apply to different tests. And again, going back to the intent of Article 11, Section 5, the Constitutional Convention clearly was looking towards the reasonable test. And that's, I think, referenced by your court's citation in the Vogel back to those proceedings.
Why doesn't the private attorney general doctrine apply in this case?
Well, Your Honor, private attorney general, we're going to the attorney's fees issue that is before you. That really has never been adopted in Hawaii, first and foremost. Secondly, here, there is, this is not a situation where the courts really should try to entertain a new form of attorney's fees relief. The legislature has specifically spoken to the question of an award of attorney's fees where Chapter 343 is involved, and that is through HRS 60725. And HRS 60725 specifically only applies to when a private party is suing another private party.
I asked you about the private attorney general.
No, and the reason I go there, Your Honor, is because the legislature has spoken to when attorney's fees should be awarded when Chapter 343 is involved. And where they have spoken, our position simply is like...
That's not fair. That statute has to do with since it was private parties.
That's right.
So you don't fit in that statute.
And Your Honor, respectfully, that's exactly my point, is that the legislature has in fact made that determination that with regards to Chapter 343 type actions, it should only be with regards to private parties versus private parties.
They include a lot of other actions in the
government. I think that's probably true. I would agree with that, Your Honor. But the other thing on the...
But the fact that they enact the special statute allowing private parties, so many private parties, of course, the permit process, does that mean that by doing that, they meant to exclude the state from liability for attorneys?
I think so, Your Honor. That's exactly the position. It doesn't say that, but I would say that that's the...
Is that in the legislative history of the act?
I don't know that there is any legislative history that speaks to that, but the fact that they specifically chose to write out any fees against the government, I think, is an important interpretation of that statute. The other thing I'd submit on that issue, Your Honor, is simply in the Alyeska case that was cited, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has recognized that where the legislature has spoken on fees, then it's really, it wasn't the court's place to legislate the appropriate, the, whether fees can be
okay. Settled. I mean, they make an argument that, you know, we've talked about private attorney general fees even after all this stuff. But when you, assuming that some fee theory would apply, would that support an award of fees in the first appeal in this case?
Well, if I'm understanding your question, you're assuming that there was some statute that allowed for fees to
apply. Statute or not.
Okay. And then your question would be whether after the first appeal, attorney's fees would apply?
Yes, would attorney's fees apply to the first appeal?
I think, Your Honor, my answer would be no. The underlying bedrock principle for attorney's fees is that it goes to the prevailing party. And prevailing party, you know, in all of the case law, looks to the final judgment. There was no final judgment in this case, and there still is no final judgment in this case. In fact, the efforts by plaintiffs to suggest that this court's judgment on appeal is a final judgment is contrary to what even they said at the November 14th hearing, lifting the injunction. The other motion that was heard that day...
You're saying that we have not awarded attorneys fees when judgments are entered on appeal and the balance of the case or some part of the case is remanded?
Oh. I don't know that for a fact, Your Honor, but my point is attorney's fees, the bedrock principle is that attorney's fees, if there is a mechanism to do it, because the American rule is everybody pays their own fees, but if there's a mechanism or statute, it's based on the prevailing party status for the most part. And Your Honor, I know I only have a few minutes left, and if I may, I would like to address the important issues that we brought up with regards to separation of powers. The Plough case is of really no moment for this particular case. The Plough case dealt with a situation where there was a final judgment on money damages. And those are significant distinctions in all of the case law that followed Plough and that Plough is a part of, including the Robertson case and the Miller case, which are both cases from the United States Supreme Court. They make the very hard distinction that if there is no final judgment and you're dealing also with a case where it's injunctive relief going forward, then Congress and legislatures are free to change the law, and courts are obligated to apply the change in the law. In the Robertson case that dealt with the spotted owl situation in the Pacific Northwest, there were injunctions in place by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and another court. And Congress, in order to address that situation, which dealt with whether timber could be sold out of the Oregon, Washington area, Congress acted, and even though there was an existing injunction, the United States Supreme Court said it's absolutely appropriate that that new change in law should be applied with regards to the injunction going forward prospectively. That's exactly what happened in this case. Here, Your Honor, there was a significant decision that this court issued in August of last year. The scope of that decision was specifically as to the application of Chapter 343. When Act 2 was passed in November of last year, it completely changed the underlying law that applies here. And Chapter 343 is no longer the applicable law going forward. Now, there was an injunction in place.
When you say that, if you read the Act, are there any provisions in the Act that that Act retroactive?
No, in fact, the way that the circuit court applied it was all going forward. If you look back at the courts.
No, I'm talking about the language of the Act. Are there provisions in the language of the Act which act retroactive?
I think what you're referring to, Your Honor, is that it does reference agreements, it references tariffs, it references
improvements
that have been made. Sure. But that's not retroactive in the sense of the injunction.
Well, that's my question.
Yes.
In Act 2, going to the Article 3 argument, are there provisions in the Act which operate retroactively?
The way that it was applied prospectively to injunctions, to an injunction that was in place by the circuit court. So my answer is, as applied to this case, the answer would be no. Importantly, when this court decided the opinion in August of last year, it did not, in fact, address injunctions.
You're saying your position is there's no language in the Act which operates retroactively.
I'm not saying that there's nothing that operates retroactively. I'm saying as applied by the circuit court, it was applied prospectively to the injunction. And on your question earlier, Your Honor, on the automatic implementation of Chapter 343, in this court's decision of August of last year, it cites the Ocean Advocates case at page 95. That's a significant case because injunctions do not automatically flow when there's a determination that an environmental review statute has been violated. In fact, it is absolutely appropriate that there be a balance of the harms done, and that's what I submit to you the circuit court did. An injunction does not automatically flow, and in fact, the case that you cited, the Ocean Advocates case, speaks to that. You know, I would like to give
The judge issued an oral order granting the permanent injunction. Then the legislature passed the act, and then the judge entered findings of fact in support of the oral and written order that's granting permanent injunction. So if that's the case, was there a judicially sanctioned change in the relationship of the parties before Act 2 was effective?
Your Honor, this is what I would say to that. With regards to prospective injunctions, it wouldn't have mattered if, in fact, there was a final judgment. If you look at Miller case, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case, there was an injunction in place for 12 years with regards to prison conditions. In 12 years, and then there was a new law passed by Congress. After 12 years, they went back to the court, and the injunction was lifted in light of this new law. Same thing in the Protecto Seal case that we cited. An injunction was entered 17 years later, final judgment entered. 17 years later, the law is changed, and the injunction going forward 17 years later is lifted. If there's a final judgment and an injunctive relief action, the courts go back and they apply the new law going forward. That's appropriate under the whole line of U.S. Supreme Court cases we've cited, as well as the other Protective Seal and the other cases that we've cited. It's also appropriate under Rule 60B of the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure, which says that injunctions going forward, you can get relief from them, but equity no longer allows for that relief. Senor Fahey? Itself. I believe the test needs to then, even if it did create a class of one, which it did, I believe, even if it did, you look to the public purpose of the statute. And if there is a reasonable basis for that classification, then under BOLGO, it is not an inappropriate special legislation. Here, the legislature articulated a whole slew of public interest, public purpose, for having this new innovative alternative transportation vehicle, and that was to impact the ability for people to move inter island, agriculture.
I think that I understand what this is for, version. Does it seem like Google was involved in class one?
Well, I think, Your Honor, we can certainly say that there were other counties, but there clearly were no other counties to which that.
I understand what you're saying, but it would seem that perhaps Bolton now needs to be corrected, but I believe that Mr. Hall would like to see the test from Chancellor apply here, and that is whether the law created accessory class, where it was logically and factually limited to a class of one. Now, if that test was applied, certainly it would be Act 2 special legislation.
I think it would be a closer question, Your Honor. I don't think it would necessarily invalidate the law. But what I will tell you in response to that, if I may, is that the Colorado test is not, I believe, the majority test. We've pointed out cases from New Jersey, Illinois, and Washington, the Seattle Mariners case, the Washington case. Those all apply the same test that was applied in Oregon. And that is, in fact, I believe, the appropriate test, and that has been the test in Hawaii, and I don't believe that it should be changed.
So I think in Seattle Mariners, clearly, that doesn't help you because the mentioned the fact that because there was only one county that could satisfy the requirement in the statute, there were other counties that existed and in the future they could go. So there wasn't a 9 or 10 month limit on the law. So in fact, the court said that was fine because the class was open rather than closed. It could include counties whose population could grow in the future and didn't exclude counties and discriminate, in effect, discriminate against them.
That is the plaintiff's view of that case.
I think that's what Seattle Mariners said.
Well, if I could, Your Honor, that law also provided that if in a year and a half, a Major League Baseball team had not committed $45 million to help pay for the facilities and had not entered a contract to have X number of home games, then that law no longer applied, essentially.
But so it applied to one county.
No, right. Well, it's to your point that in the future, other counties could get to a million in population. That really was not realistic here because it really was a 1.5 year time period that applied there. Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the court, my name is Lisa Munger. I'm arguing this morning on behalf of Hawaii Super Ferry, and I'd by acknowledging Carly Minner Cole, who assisted me in preparing for the argument today. I'd also like to indicate that I was to devote my 10 minutes to the subject of attorney's fees, and we run a bit long. So I thought if I could be as brief as I can be, and I hope I won't inconvenience the court by simply just talking too fast. Before addressing the subject of attorney's fees, there was one item with respect to Act 2 on which I wish to correct the record, and not to reopen argument, but to clarify. Justice Acoba asked if Chapter 343 has a non-implementation clause, why was the injunction hearing necessary? And I may have misunderstood Mr. Hall's remarks, but I heard him to suggest that the parties agreed on that score. I just wanted the record to be clear that the parties disputed that there was a non-implementation clause. And if it's of a concern to the court, I'm happy to provide a supplemental letter indicating where in the record that briefing and argument occurred. There was no agreement between the parties with respect to an alleged non-implementation clause. Turning to the subject of attorney's fees very briefly, I think that Ms. Ganoza has addressed the prevailing party's point in connection with her argument with respect to the legislature's enactment. So let me turn from that to Hawaii Revised Statute Section 607.25 and its application. She's addressed it with respect to the state. It's not a private party, obviously. With respect to Hawaii Super Ferry, I again contend that that law does not apply. Hawaii Super Ferry is not a party who undertook the development without obtaining the necessary permits. As this court ruled in its initial Super Ferry decision, it was the Department of Transportation, not Hawaii Super Ferry, that was obligated to comply with Chapter 343. Super Ferry was not an action. It was not an applicant requiring a discretionary permit. Second,
acknowledging that we haven't explicitly adopted the private attorney general theory, why would it not apply in this case?
Your Honor, I strenuously would suggest to the court that this would not be an appropriate opportunity to adopt the private attorney general doctrine, because what we have here is a case solely concerning an environmental statute. This case was brought under Chapter 343, and the legislature first, of course, could, in adopting 343 itself or any of the numerous times it's been amended, could have added an attorney's fees provision to that statute. Instead, in 1986, the legislature adopted 607.25 and included within that section an opportunity for attorney's fees in some, but not all, Chapter 343 cases. And particularly what the legislature did was indicate in Section D that for purposes of that statute, only procedural violations of Chapter 343, not substantive ones, were eligible for attorney's fees. Hence, if you, for example, if you performed an EIS, but the court later concluded that the EIS was inadequate, that would not qualify. And also, of course, provided a safe harbor for people like Hawaii Super Ferry who rely on an exemption determination. So in this case, if the court were to adopt the private attorney general doctrine here, in effect, what the court would be doing would be to be rewriting 607.25 in four ways. First, it would be applying it to the state of Hawaii, which is not a private party. Second, it would be applying it to a non-prevailing party. Third, it would be applying it to a Hawaii Super Ferry, which has not violated Chapter 343. And fourth, it would be writing out the safe harbor provision. So that's a rather long-winded way of saying when the legislature has already grappled with an issue and determined in which case and in what circumstances attorney's fees would be appropriate, that is not the case we agree we would suggest where the private attorney general doctrine should be applied.
Do you agree the private attorney general doctrine can apply to private parties?
Your Honor, I still uncomfortable with the private attorney general doctrine applying to private parties. If we looked at the history of the private attorney general doctrine, it's applied in cases where the courts find that the state has somehow abandoned fundamental rights. This is, in this case, this is a private party applying for permits. That's not a case where the private attorney general doctrine should apply. Particularly, whereas here they rely on the Department of Transportation, the Office of Environmental Quality Control, as well as the First Circuit Court in reaching its determination. Your Honors, I have a great deal more to say on the subject, but I think I would prefer to save the last moment I have for a moment of rebuttal to Mr. Hall, if the court will permit.
I'd just like to say a few words about Volvo. I don't think a class of one was created in Volvo. The whole point of special legislation is either it confers a special benefit or a special immunity on a single class member. And the case is quite clear when it holds that it neither favors nor discriminates against the county of Maui. There were the classes created were the classes of the three counties at the time, Big Island, Kauai, Maui. There may have been one person to whom the legislation applied, but there were still three classes, and it could have applied, and the court was quite clear in saying that, to somebody else who died before they could take office from Kauai or from the Big Island in the future. So that I don't think the class, closed class, is even created by this legislation. I don't agree that there's any clear test that is created by Volvo, as was argued to you. And I would agree that if we're talking about tests, the canister test is a test to be applied. And at bottom, at worst, I've heard it mentioned several times here that if necessary to hold that Volvo was not deciding correctly, I would urge you to decide that. Now, several things have been said about Plout and Robertson, and I'd like to discuss them for just a second. I don't believe in Robertson and that whole line of cases that there are final judgments from the highest court in the Article III hierarchy, and that would be the U.S. Supreme Court. Those are federal cases, and there weren't judgments there. There's a lot of discussion about Miller versus French, but that's a very, very different situation than we have here. And Miller, there was is a prisoner's rights case where there was an injunctive order issued about overcrowding, et cetera. And then Congress, 7 years later, passed a statute that didn't go to the relief that was granted. It didn't attempt to take that relief away. It simply said, if you want to file a motion to dissolve an injunction, that injunction later, there you have to meet your motion to dissolve that injunction must show that the relief was narrowly tailored to meet the relief that was initially granted, and there will be a stay of the so-called stay. If it takes too long to decide that motion, we're going to stay the injunctive relief for 30 to 60 days. And what the court said in Miller v. French was, there's nothing unconstitutional about a 30 to 60 day stay of the stay of injunctive relief. It didn't have anything to do with the initial relief that was granted. It didn't threaten that for any more than 30 to 60 days, and it certainly didn't threaten any initial injunction. One case we did cite that is more on point is Bush v. Schiavo, which is a state court case in Florida, where the trial court issued a ruling that nutrition could be withdrawn from Terry Schiavo. It went all the way up to the highest court in Florida and was affirmed. Then the legislature said, okay, Jeb Bush can pull that. And that then went up. And if the argument was made, well, the Florida court held that's unconstitutional because there is a ruling from the highest court in the Florida hierarchy that can be done. And that can't be attacked. And the governor argued in that court, well, so long as Terry Perry Schiavo was alive, that can be modified as prospective relief. And the court held, no, that's a final judgment of the highest court in the Article III hierarchy in Florida. It cannot be done. And so you've got an interplay here of final judgments from the highest state court and prospective relief. And if that prospective relief attacks the judgment of the highest court, it can't be done. So what I think has to be done here is you have to look, what did you as the highest court finally decide? You finally decided we're entitled to an EA pursuant to Chapter 343. That could not be taken away from us by the legislature. The legislature might have been able to do something that would require a reassessment of injunctive relief going into the future, but it couldn't be, whatever that was, it could not be inconsistent with an EIS or an EA prepared pursuant to Chapter 343. That we still were entitled to an EA prepared with the content requirements of Chapter 343, the non-implementation requirements of Chapter 343, with the right to appeal, etc. That could not be taken away by the legislature. Now, I guess I'm supposed to address attorney's fees.
You agree, Mr. Hall, that 706.25 does not apply in this case.
706.25.
I
think it does apply. Judge Cardoza awarded us attorney's fees based on 607.25 and the private attorney general document.
What about all the requirements in that statute about giving notice to the developer, etc.?
Right. Well, first of all, I think we met the elements of that claim. That is, it's a private injunctive relief against a private entity, Hawaii Superior, and they developed and they violated the procedure requirement, Chapter 343. I think what you're addressing is the court can award attorney's fees either on a discretionary basis or on a mandatory basis, or then they cannot award attorney's fees if Hawaii Superferry, in this instance, got a letter in advance from HDOT that an EA was not required, and they relied on that in good faith. I think maybe you're talking about that. Did they do that in this case?
Yeah. Section 3 of that.
Yeah,
provision says, notwithstanding any provision to the contrary, the court shall not award attorney's fees.
Correct. Yes.
And then it goes on to say the party undertaking the development shall provide a copy of the written statement to the party bringing the civil action not within 30 days after receiving written notice of any violation.
That never happened.
That never happened. So then the court cannot award attorney's fees.
If we want attorney's fees on a mandatory basis, we have to give notice to them.
The section starts off, notwithstanding any provision to the contrary of the section.
Yeah.
Which I would assume would incorporate both the discretionary and mandatory award of attorney's fees.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If they relied in good faith on some documentation from DOT that the EA wasn't required and provided.
Yeah, good faith, though, that section.
Yeah, relying in good faith is what we contest. They relied in good faith on anything.
Well, aside from good faith, that section requires that a copy of the written statement be filed not within 30 days. You say that didn't happen.
Well, what they're saying is they were relying on the exemption determination itself. We all knew about the exemption determination. I'm not saying we didn't. They didn't provide it to us and say, here, we're relying on this to protect themselves from attorney's fees. They didn't do that. But everybody was aware of the exemption determination. But the heart of that issue.
Why are you the prevailing party?
We're the prevailing party, number one, if you hold Act 2 as unconstitutional, we're the prevailing party. Number two, 607-25. Is unaffected by Act 2. Act 2 says nothing about 607-25. That claim arose after the operating agreement was signed in November of 2005, and when the development was so-called constructed all the way up till they first implemented in August of 2005. 2007. Act Two went into effect in November 2nd, 2007. So our whole claim over 607-25 arose prior to the effective date of Act Two. That whole claim had to do with pre-Act Two events, and that's why it's not affected by Act Two. So what we are saying, the three elements of that claim are that there's a super injunctive relief by us against a private party, which is by Superferry, for conducting development, what constitutes development under the statute, and what White Superferry did on the state lands in Kozomi Harbor is meets the definition of development. And that was so found by Judge Cardoza in his finding of fact. And White Superferry violated the procedural requirements of Chapter 343.
The fact that the court ordered, issued an oral order, a written order, saying you were entitled to a permanent injunction before Act became effective, does that make you look to that party?
In part. For the purposes, I'm saying we prevailed on our 607-25 claim because that took place before Act 2 was even in effect. They're saying we can't prevail because Act 2 took everything away from us. Act 2 didn't take our 607-25 claim away from us. We prevailed on that before Act 2 was even in effect. And we prevailed on the private attorney general doctrine claim, which would have been affected and was affected by Act 2, I admit.
I'm asking you, in effect, the court's written order granting you permanent injunction.
On a private attorney general doctrine claim, we prevailed on that because we prevailed before you, number one, on a decision reversing the exemption determination on the decision that an EA was required, and that relief that we got from you was so-called, as a language they use, actualized through 80 days of injunctive relief. Yes, that's what I believe. And that has been sufficient. What the courts have said is
insufficient. You don't have a final judgment. How can you get around that?
You don't have to have a final judgment under any of those federal cases that are in sight. What the cases say, they say what's not enough, you can't just win on a discovery motion. You can't go out of the court empty-handed. The Soul versus Weiner case, I don't dispute that, but that's where they went in and in a telephone conference without any discovery or anything, got a preliminary injunction that when they did have a full-blown evidentiary hearing, they lost. That's not comparable to our situation. On the other hand, what is sufficient is cases that have held that when you get less than the a final judgment, that's sufficient to be the prevailing party. It's sufficient if you get some of the relief, but not all of the relief that you prayed for. And certainly, if you get 80 days of injunctive relief, as we did, as well as a landmark decision from you, I think that qualifies for prevailing party status under the existing case law.
If I could just very briefly correct certain statements made by Mr. Paul that are not supported by the record. First, the statement that Superferry developed and they violated Chapter 343, and that is in the judge's order. There is no such finding at any time that Hawaii Superferry violated Chapter 343 at any time. Secondly, Your Honor, with respect to this, they never gave us notice. That never happened. That is demonstrably false. The plaintiffs in this case didn't send us a notice saying, please, we're concerned you're going to start a development. They filed a lawsuit, they attached the written determination, and they told us that written determination was erroneous. The plaintiffs, when they gave us the notice, acknowledged and at all times had the written determination. With respect to the statement that we always had a 607-25 claim. They can't take that away from us. There's no such count in the complaint of a 607-25 claim. That's relief in the event of a 343 violation. Simply stated, there can be no award against either the state or Superferry under 607-25. That is not at all the this statute was meant to do, and similarly under the private attorney general doctrine, would be to rewrite that statute completely in order to avoid these. Thank you very much for indulging me with that clarification of the record, Your Honor.
Court will take this appointed matter of advisement.
Please rise. This Honorable Supreme Court of State of Hawaii stands adjourned until further notice.